From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, is the boom in oil production that some have predicted with the Monterey Shale and technology like fracking actually happening right now? We'll talk with Lois Henry of the Bakersfield Californian about a new discovery that has industry and environmental groups taking notice. We'll also talk about a new effort to give Fresno a dashboard, one where you can track key data points and see where the community is performing and in what areas it isn't, in everything from education and poverty to arts and culture. It's called the Fresno Community Scorecard. And we'll get a preview of two big-name jazz stars visiting the Valley tonight and tomorrow, courtesy of Jazz Fresno. But first, the California drought is becoming a source of tension between homeowners and farmers throughout the San Joaquin Valley. Farmers are seeing unprecedented reductions in their allotments to surface water. Homeowners are watching their private wells run dry. Pauline Bartolone has more about how some people in the Fresno area are tapping into the aquifer with mixed results.
The home where Ruth Griffin plans to retire looks like it's on an island in a sea of almond orchards.
Well, it's trees everywhere, which is great, except whenever they're having to water day and night.
Griffin's brand new house is in the heart of California farm country. It's outside a town called Kingsburg, just south of Fresno.
I've lived here all my life. I'll be 70 next month, two children, and I spent my life savings to build this home, and now we can't use it.
About a month before she planned to move into her new home, her well went dry. Now, when she opens her bathroom faucet, nothing comes out.
Well, I hate turning on really because if there's anything in the sink, nothing in the well, nothing in the tank.
Griffin will have to spend at least $17,000 to drill a deeper well that will reach the underground water table. She's on an 8-month waiting list.
We'll have to get water somehow, even if we have to truck it in.
Griffin says the water problems may be from drought, but she also blames the farmers next door. From the second floor of her house, she has a clear view of a swimming pool-sized basin of fresh water on the farmer's property. She says they pump it from the aquifer, a shared underground pool of water.
And it kind of irritates you a little bit to see all that water over there, and I see my neighbors, they have 10 dogs, swimming in the pond.
But you can't access it.
But I can't access it at all, huh?
State studies show groundwater levels in the area are 100 feet below the historic low.
Usually when people are on a private well, it's sort of a pioneer spirit, an attitude of self-sufficiency.
Sue Reese is with an organization called Self-Help Enterprises. She's a resource for people in the San Joaquin Valley when their well runs dry. In her small town of Easton, she estimates more than half of private well owners will have dry wells within a few years. She says investing to drill deeper is easier for some than others. In the meantime, Reese says homeowners adjust.
If you're lucky enough to live in a community, you could put a hose next to your neighbor's if your neighbor happens to have water. And so you can live off of a hose for a while, a garden hose, drink bottled water, you know, just be conservative with the water and survive.
Farmers say homeowners are not the only ones having a hard time during this drought. California Farm Bureau President Paul Wenger.
They're part of the problem, too, because they're there. And their demands have to be met. People want drinking water. Well, that farmer, if he doesn't have water, his crop dries up.
Wenger says he's never seen such severe effects on California agriculture, not because this is the driest year, but because of the unprecedented cutbacks on surface water. He says that's why groundwater is being overdrawn in some places. In other regions, farmers are relying completely on groundwater.
What would the Central Valley look like if we didn't have agriculture today? It'd be tumbleweeds, and that's about it. Not even probably jackrabbits.
Wenger says homeowners just have to drill deeper. It's a drought-induced scramble with farmers and homeowners as competitors.
Nothing's an even playing field, ever. And that's why you have to think about when some people built their homes where they bought it or they bought their home, it is still buyer beware.
But Peter Glick with the Pacific Institute says the problem is the lack of state water management.
We don't manage and control our groundwater in a sustainable way, and especially during a drought, when there's not a lot of surface water, people start to pump and overpump groundwater, and it's a tragedy of the commons.
He says California is one of the only states in the country that doesn't have comprehensive groundwater policy.
If you don't know how much groundwater is being pumped or how much you're taking or how much your neighbors are taking, it makes it hard to control it. And that's to the advantage of some people and to the disadvantage of others.
The state is working on a groundwater management plan right now, but any actions will be taken over the next 5 years. In Sacramento, I'm Pauline Bartolone.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Last month was filled with news about fracking, controversial oil extraction technology that fuels much of the economy of Kern County. On May 30th, a bill that would have placed a moratorium on hydraulic fracturing while the state studied its potential risks died in the Senate. Earlier in the month, the federal government issued a report that dramatically reduced the official estimate of the amount of Monterey shale oil that could be economically recovered in Central California using current technology. While those were big stories in May, June may even hold a bigger one, at least according to our next guest, Bakersfield, Californian columnist Lois Henry, who joins us now. Lois, welcome.
Thanks, Joe.
Your column from just over a week ago talks about something that you've come across in regards to production from Occidental Petroleum's oil fields in Kern County, and there's something interesting going on here.
I think there's something really interesting going on here, and I think it could potentially negate the federal government's estimate that we can't get at the oil economically that's in the Monterey Shale. I have been stocking a particular well of Oxy's for, I guess, since like October, November, because I'd heard through the grapevine that they drilled it. It's very far south. It's in the Mettler area, so it's west of I-5. It's south of Taft. It's in this sort of no man's land. It used to, they had a scattering of oil wells drilled there in the 60s. They kind of gave up. They're almost all plugged. Well, in the midst of this, Oxy had drilled this well, which just for purposes of ease, I'll call 15H. And they were producing light, sweet crude to the tune of 2,000 barrels a day out of that 15H. And that's when I caught wind of it, and I started going out and looking at it. And unfortunately, you can look it up on the DOGGR site, which is Department of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources. You can look that up, but they allow operators to file what's known as confidential wells, and so you can't get the well record, meaning how much they produce, for 2 years. It can be confidential for 2 years. Now, I don't understand why, but that's the way it is. So I went out and looked at, what kind of permits would they, if this thing is producing that much, what would they want to do with this oil that's coming out? And remember, it's light sweet crude, so, that's much nicer than most of the oil that we produce here in Kern County, which is heavy, it's harder to refine, it's got a lot of sulfur and stuff. So this is definitely what geologists consider the Monterey Shale to be like. Anyway, so through a series of looking up permits from, county encroachments to different pipeline permits and air district permits, I learned that they were building 3 8-inch pipelines from 15H going west to tie into the Plains All America pipeline, which takes, just a ton of oil down to refineries in LA. And what I understand is 3 8-inch pipelines has the capability of taking, 42,000 barrels a day. So I kind of was like, that, caught me, oh my goodness, what are they planning? And so we're just talking about one well here. And then, I turned around and blinked, and I looked back at the DOGGR site, and there were 7 wells that they had dropped just within, a few weeks, right around there. So I think there's something going on here that's more than just, oh, look, we found this new field. Because, like I said, this has been an explored field since the 60s, since the 40s in some cases. I think Oxy has a new technology. That's my complete and total and utter speculation. They have a new technology that they're using, probably in conjunction with fracking, although I couldn't find any mention of these wells on the site Frack Focus. That's kind of a voluntary thing while the Pavley bill kicks in on requiring reporting fracking. But since it's voluntary, a lot of people aren't doing it. And so I don't know whether those are fracked wells or not, but I can assume if it's Monterey Shale, you kind of have to frack that formation. And as you know, I'm sure you and I have talked about this before, the Monterey Shale is not like the Bakken, which, is sort of laid down, if you can imagine, you know, a bunch of papers stacked on top of each other. Those are the shale formations. And then you go down and you drill horizontally and you, you know, pump a bunch of what they call proppants and water down there and you fracture it. And then the oil migrates nice and neatly down those fractures into your borehole. Well, Monterey Shale, if you imagine those papers all sort of laid up on top of each other, but then because of our seismic activity in California, somebody just comes along and crumples them all up. That's what the Monterey Shale is. It's a very technically difficult formation. I actually covered it 20-some years ago when they first started fracking in the North Shafter Field. And the problem was they would frack it, they would get a nice play for about a month, a real nice gusher, and then 2 months later it would choke down to nothing. So that's been the real challenge with Monterey Shale. And since Oxy is continuing to drop more wells and continuing to, you know, pump more oil into those lines they built, I can only assume that they have somehow developed some technology that is aiding in that.
Now, there's a couple of interesting things that this brings up. Number one, for the last few months, we've been hearing folks in the energy industry talking about how the Pavley bill, that's the existing fracking regulations that are on the books right now, signed by the governor last year and now are being implemented, that those are already slowing down production in permitting of new wells and are consequently having an impact on employment in the industry. Does this somewhat run counter to that, do you think?
I'm kind of wondering if Oxy started the permitting, because yes, you're right. This is what I'm hearing as well, is that there's a big slowdown in the industry, a big bottleneck. And I'm wondering if Oxy, you know, had these in the pipeline long before the bill became a law, because remember, this is all in conjunction with Oxy spinning off its California operations, which they had in process like March of 2013 is when they first started announcing that they were going to do that. So if they have this new technology and they're going to spin off this company, they may have started doing the permit process back then before the Pavley bill was signed. That's my only assumption, because they're moving fast. I mean, when you look on Dogger's site and, you know, within a month or two you see more oil wells that are dropped, it's kind of amazing, considering the fact that everyone else is, yeah, sort of standing in line and, you know, twiddling their thumbs and wondering what's going on. And I've heard from oil guys, you know, they're actually going to the ag water districts to try and get help for monitoring wells, because they don't do water monitoring as a general rule. And so they're going to the ag guys to, like, hey, can you help us out? You know, can we use your wells? What are we looking for? So, yeah, there's definitely a bottleneck. But I think maybe Oxy maybe might have come in, you know, a little under the wire for the stuff that I'm looking at. So we'll have to see how they proceed in the future.
The other interesting thing here is that for so long we've talked about the Monterey Shale, and for the most part it's been this looming behemoth out there that maybe someday might be a major source of production for Central California in the future and give new life to some of these older fields. But as you said, the technology hasn't been there. Just recently we saw that report from the federal government saying that with the current technology that we have, a huge amount of that potential oil is unrecoverable. With this being new technology, is that exactly what the Energy Information Administration was not talking about in that study?
Yeah, I just think that Oxy's, I mean, they're a company that holds their cards close to the vest anyway, but I think Oxy's trying to perfect this, probably don't want to tell the world, hey, you know, look what we got, and then it turns, you know, egg on their face or something. And so, you know, they're probably not obviously telling the government about it, and whatever's happening is working for them. So I think it's important to watch what happens with them, see how the wells proceed, see if they continue. Because in their registration statement for the new California Resources Corporation, which they're forming, they said that next to this, they described the well and the field that I have been literally stalking, I've been going out there and sort of looking at it and seeing what's going on. And they described that field as an example of how they came into an old dead area and, you know, using this new technology and their proprietary techniques, they have made it play, and that they have plans for 150 more wells in that area. So we shall see what we shall see coming up. But I think, you know, they're not going to tell the federal government, obviously, what they're up to. And the government looked at this whole thing and said, yeah, if you can't make it produce using technology that you have, you know, it's unrecoverable at this point. Well, I think they might have been a little quick on the draw with that, because I do think Oxy has something going on there.
Again, if you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with Lois Henry of the Bakersfield Californian about some of her recent columns, and in this case, the potential for a big new oil find that might be underway right now. Who knows? We're certainly following that, and Lois is doing a great job, as she said, stalking that oil field. I want to move on to another one and bring up one of the most interesting and oddest news stories that I have seen in Central California in the last year or so, and that's the case of Bakersfield City Manager Alan Tandy, who is accused or is alleged to have been involved in an assault that took place at an ice center in Bakersfield at an amateur hockey game. Sides have lawyered up now. Is that correct?
Yeah, the story kind of was hot last week, and then at the end of the week, you know, each side had gotten representation, and now the lawyers are speaking for them, and it's just, it's the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen in my entire life. If your listeners have the opportunity to go on the internet and look at the video, please do. It was, first of all, these guys, you know, are middle-aged, later middle-aged, like CPAs and civil servants, et cetera, et cetera. You know, they're not some bunch of bikers on meth or something. They're responsible adults, and yet they play these hockey games where, from what I've heard, this is kind of par for the course, other than, you know, Alan Tandy hit the one guy over the head from behind with his hockey stick. That was a little, even for these hockey guys, that was a little out of bounds. But apparently it's just this beer league, and these guys, you know, get out there and they get all hot-headed and, I don't know, want to relive their youth or something by getting into silly scuffles. And so what happened was, in this case, the game was over and this handshake line was even over, and one guy from the Bears said something to one guy from the Blues, and that's Alan Tandy's team. So those two guys got into it, and Alan Tandy, you can see from the video, he's standing behind them as they're scuffling and just whacks the one guy over the head with his stick from behind. I mean, it's like, what on earth is wrong with you people? I mean, my goodness, I can't even tell you how we're all just like, you know, slack-jawed over this. Like, really? And instead of coming out and saying, you know, oh, I was overwrought or I overreacted or whatnot, now, you know, Alan is coming out basically saying I was completely justified and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And it's gotten into this, you know, it's just gotten into this, everybody's got their back up and nobody's looking at it like, that was stupid. I mean, let's not do that again.
And the alleged victim in this case happens to be the manager of the Shafter Airport.
Right. I mean, you know, not some fly-by-night redneck with, you know, anger management issues, or at least you would think, but they get out on that hockey rink, and I don't know what it is. They have sticks in their hands, and they've got all padded up, and they think that they're, you know, 10 feet tall and bulletproof, and it's just ridiculous. I think they should both be banned from the ice rink forever.
Given that city manager Alan Tandy and his team also includes the deputy city manager against this other team with the airport manager for the city of Shafter, is there some rivalry that's being expressed on the ice here? And is this some way that official business is conducted in some way?
I sure hope not, but yes, there is no love lost between Shafter officials and Bakersfield officials. They have had lawsuits. They've had all kinds of arguments about spheres of influence, on and on and on. There's really, and Alan has not engendered very much love with our city to the north. Alan is very, what you might call a very tough negotiator, not always the most cordial person. And, you know, these fights have escalated into lawsuits. I don't mean to say physical fights, but these arguments and these disagreements have escalated into lawsuits, and they've sort of drug on and on and on. So there's no love lost between those two. Now, whether this is their way of, you know, trying to settle a tax issue, I don't know, but I still say it's not the right way to do it.
Well, certainly interesting, and we'll have to see if maybe this trend of politicians and other folks in government suiting up and taking to the ice spreads to Sacramento. That could make for some interesting, interesting.
God. Could you imagine?
Work for political reporters up in the state capitol.
I'm going to say, never a dull moment in Bakersfield.
Yes, indeed. Again, our guest today is Lois Henry, columnist with the Bakersfield Californian. You can read her work online at bakersfield.com. Lois, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and talk about a new effort to gauge the performance of a variety of sectors of the Fresno community in something called the Fresno Community Scorecard. Think of it as a dashboard for all of the city's vital signs. It's coming up next on Valley Edition.
The Vineyard Restaurant in Madera will host Valley Public Radio's next restaurant takeover, Thursday, June 26th. Here's owner Chris Mariscotti.
For the dinner that night, just talked to my friend who grows figs, and he's going to have the first crop available, so we'll have them for the 26th. One of our real popular appetizers we do is a Mission Figs wrapped with bacon and grilled and drizzled with balsamic vinegar.
Purchase restaurant takeover tickets at kvpr.org. Proceeds benefit Valley Public Radio.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. We all know that communities up and down the Central Valley face a wide range of challenges, from education to unemployment. And there's literally thousands of individuals working on solutions to those problems every day, from the public sector to the private sector. But are those efforts working? And if so, which ones are actually having an impact and which ones aren't? For the residents of Fresno, there's a new effort underway to bring that data to the public. It's called the Fresno Community Scorecard. It launches this week. And here to tell us more is Christine Walter from the Fresno Business Council, which helped to put together this project. Christine, welcome.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Your group says the scorecard tracks 150 different data points on the community's performance. Exactly what are we talking about here, and what sorts of categories are you looking at with the scorecard?
Right, Joe. Well, yes, there are 150 different indicators in 11 different categories. What we did is we convened a broad-based group of stakeholders across the community and asked the question, what are the indicators, what are the categories we need to be looking at in order to have a robust 360 view of how our community is doing? The categories that were selected include, of course, safety, education, economic vitality, but also include some categories that aren't always tracked, and that has to do with who are the people that live in our community? What about culture and the quality of life? Equity, of course, sustainable infrastructure, housing, health, strong families. These are some of the topics that are included in the categories we have.
The data here on the scorecard isn't necessarily new. It comes from a variety of sources, federal agencies, local agencies, all sorts of different data sets that are oftentimes very hard to navigate. If you're looking for something, it can be very cumbersome and sometimes to find it. Why did the Business Council take this on, and what do you feel the importance of putting this all together in one spot is?
Well, we know that in order to move an indicator in any direction, you really have to measure things. There are numbers of interesting quotes that say that same thing. And we just felt that as a business community, the Business Council and, of course, Valley PBS, who is our co-partner in this effort, wanted to look at what we could do to raise awareness about building a healthy, prosperous, and sustainable community. That is what our goal is. So we looked at where we could put all these indicators together, and we came up with the scorecard.
It's great to be able to show people all in one spot different data sets from so many different categories. How do you hope people will use this? Is it going to be of interest beyond policy wonks and grant makers? Is this something that the average ordinary citizen can look at? And how do you hope people use the scorecard?
Well, first and foremost, we're hoping that this is going to be engaging community leaders in a broader conversation. This is neutral data. It's convened through relevant, reliable, neutral data sources. And what we want to do is have informed decision-making, not only with the policy wonks and the funders, but also with people who are voting, with people who are engaged in building a prosperous and a sustainable community. We're hoping that it will also inspire community action. If there is an indicator that is trending well or maybe is in need of some help, that people can actually use this scorecard and say, this is something that I really can get my arms around. We're also interested in finding out how one set of indicators can impact another set. You and I were chatting a little bit offline about how third grade reading scores can, of course, impact public safety. here is a tool that will be able to make that information relevant and quickly accessible to everybody.
Is this something that other communities are doing? Is there a model that Fresno's following to implement this scorecard?
Well, scorecards were pretty popular a couple decades ago, but we actually engaged with the University of Eastern Washington, who has put together a number of similar websites. Of course, we had a superior team of people, and we really did a lot of community stakeholder outreach in order to make sure that we were making this personalized and relevant for our community. But yes, other communities are doing very similar things. But we like to think that we've taken it to the next level here in Fresno.
I understand the scorecard is not a finished piece of work, and it never will be. This new data comes in every year. Also, new things can be added down the road, as I understand. Is that correct?
Absolutely. This is a very dynamic website, and we are planning to update it. The commitment is that the information will be updated to the website within 7 days of it being released. And as you mentioned earlier, Joe, this is information that is sourced from state, federal, county sources. The Census Bureau, of course, has information in there. So these are reliable data sources that we're going to be using. It is dynamic. We're hoping that the community will look at it, offer us input on how to make it even more relevant to them. And we want to just continue to refine this. This is an ongoing project. This is not a post it and walk away.
The scorecard is launching throughout the community this month. There's an event coming up to celebrate its launch. How can people find out about the scorecard? Where can they go to find it on their computers?
The easiest way is just to go directly to the website, which is, of course, www.fresnoscorecard.org. There is a place on there where people can connect and be given access to a newsletter. That is one thing I do want to also say, is that we will be tracking these indicators and quarterly be providing an email newsletter to those who want to sign up and are interested on how the changing data points and these indicators are being manifested in our own community. So while the information may come from state, federal, or county sources, we want to be able to drill the story down to what does that mean to people living here in our community, and how can those indicators be improved upon so that we can all have a better quality of life here in Fresno.
We've been talking with Christine Walter of the Fresno Business Council, which launches the new Fresno Community Scorecard, an online website that aims to track 150 data points about the community, ranging from things like education and poverty, unemployment, the arts, quality of life, and beyond. Christine, thank you so much for joining us today.
We appreciate the time being here. Thanks so much, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. This year, fans of the National Parks celebrate the 150th anniversary of the Yosemite Land Grant, the beginning of the Yosemite National Park and the California State Park System. A new book called Yosemite Meditation for Adventurers presents a very interesting look at the park, its landscape, and inspirational ideas from authors across the globe. Joining us now is Michael Fry. He's the photographer who put together this book that is now available through the Yosemite Conservancy and wherever better books are sold. Mr. Fry, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Yosemite is a photographer's dreamland. What is it like trying to go through your work and put together a book that documents the incredible breadth and depth of the geography, the flora, and the fauna that is Yosemite National Park?
Well, it can be challenging to, you know, to go through all of that. I've been photographing Yosemite for 30 years, and so I have a lot of images from that time. But I have to give credit to my wife, Claudia Welsh. She's the editor for this book, and she is the one who went through the images and did the hard work of finding the quotes to accompany them. And I think she does a great job of doing that, of pairing the photographs with the quotes in interesting ways.
As a photographer, you've traveled all over the world documenting landscapes, but what makes Yosemite unique? Is it just simply El Capitan and Half Dome, but is there something more than that? Is there something special beyond just the iconic monoliths about Yosemite that makes it such a special place to travel and to take photographs?
Oh, well, you know, so many things. I've lived in and near Yosemite, as I said, for 30 years, and it's a very special place to me. It's home, really. And it's so much more than, you know, than the iconic views that people know so well and are so familiar with. I mean, obviously, those are wonderful, and El Capitan and Half Dome and Yosemite Falls are just spectacular and amazing. But there's also the high country of Yosemite and, you know, the sequoias and, you know, even just the sort of the smaller scenes in Yosemite Valley. I think Yosemite is beautiful in its grand landscapes and its intimate scenes, its details, flowers and leaves in the river. You know, in some ways, what makes Yosemite Valley such a special place is this juxtaposition of these, you know, forbidding 3,000 foot high vertical cliffs, these spectacular waterfalls, with this flat, peaceful valley floor with the meandering river and meadows that you can wander around in. It's that kind of juxtaposition of this spectacular topography with a kind of inviting valley.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, our guest is photographer Michael Fry. His new book, Yosemite Meditations for Adventurers, not only includes beautiful photographs, but also inspirational quotes about, well, not just about Yosemite, but they could certainly be applied to Yosemite. Here's one from Peter Croft that I'd like to share with our listeners. For me, an adventure is something that I can take an active part in, but that I don't have total control over. That really sums up the experience of being in the national parks, especially, as you say, in the Yosemite High Country, does it not?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this book, our idea with this book was that you know, Yosemite is a wonderful place for adventure. You know, obviously, it's a place that people come from around the world to go rock climbing and, you know, they go hiking and hang gliding and so forth. But, you know, an adventure means different things for different people. And for some people, an adventure might just be, you know, going on a short hike to Vernal Fall. It's really, I kind of think of it as meant to be for people with adventurous spirits, whoever they might be. But that, you know, that quote definitely sums it up. You know, there's always this element of the unknown in any adventure. And I think sort of embracing that, you know, not being afraid or overly afraid of the unknown and embracing the possibility of discovering new things is partly what adventure in any form is all about.
You said that you've lived in Yosemite now for 30 years, spent time there for that long. Is there ever the risk of taking it for granted, or does it, you find new elements of it every day?
I absolutely find new elements every day. You know, it changes all the time. Of course, the weather changes from day to day, and things change from season to season, and every year is different. You know, this is a dry year, a drought year, and yet that, for a photographer, creates different opportunities. Interestingly, you know, you would think, oh, a wet year where the waterfalls would be fuller is always better, and of course, you know, it's great to photograph the waterfalls when they're really full, but, you know, low water levels can provide different opportunities to photograph, you know, reflections in the water and things when the water is calmer. So it's always changing. It's always different. And I keep discovering new places, just little corners of even Yosemite Valley, as many times as I've been there, little corners that I haven't really explored before. And I find interesting things to photograph when I do explore those places.
When so many people think of Yosemite, an image immediately comes to mind, and it's quite possible that that image is one from the great photographer Ansel Adams. Mm. Is it challenging to be a photographer who specializes in Yosemite and have that shadow of Ansel Adams always there and finding some new way to capture these
what are familiar landmarks?
In some ways, yeah. You know, not only Ansel, but so many other photographers, of course, have been to Yosemite and done wonderful work there. But, of course, Ansel is the kind of preeminent figure for Yosemite photography. And I worked at the Ansel Adams Gallery right in Yosemite Valley for 6 years, and so I'm very familiar with his work. And I think at first it was a little bit daunting, you know, to try to photograph a place that he and others had photographed so well. But as time went on, I think I just sort of naturally evolved my own style, I guess, my own vision, my own view of the park, and I don't really think about what came before or who did what before. At this point, I'm really just exploring the park, sort of visually reacting to the light and the weather, making photographs that I hope communicate something about what I feel about Yosemite, about the place, and you know where they happen to fall in relation to other photographs that came before is up to other people to, you know, to decide and think about. I just want to make photographs that please myself and hopefully communicate something about the beauty of the place to other people as well.
Another one of these short quotes from the book, and this one comes from the legendary Galen Rowell. I look for what I have seen before, and I follow hints of magical light the way I would follow clues on a treasure map. There's something about the light in Yosemite, is there not?
Yeah, well, John Muir, of course, famous naturalist, called the Sierra Nevada the range of light. And I think photographers who have followed along and visited that range after Muir would have to agree with that. You know, there's so much wonderful light. Well, all kinds of places have wonderful light, but there is something special about the light, I think, in the Sierra, especially, I think, in the high country. If you've ever spent some time in the high country, there's some sort of an intensity to the light that makes things seem, almost hyper-real.
We've been talking today with Michael Fry. He is a photographer whose new book is called Yosemite Meditations for Adventurers. It features his photography of Yosemite, Yosemite Valley, the high country, and beyond, and also inspirational quotes about Yosemite and about the world around us. The book is published by the Yosemite Conservancy. I understand it benefits their programs?
Yeah, the Yosemite Conservancy is the park's cooperating association, so it's a nonprofit organization that raises money to help fund projects, many wonderful projects in the park, restoration and so forth, as well as educational programs and publishing. So they've long had a very strong book publishing program as part of their educational mission.
Great. And again, it's available through the Yosemite Conservancy at the park and wherever better books are sold. Again, Michael Fry joining us today. The book is called Yosemite Meditations for Adventurers. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. While their professional organizations discourage physicians from accepting gifts from corporations that may unduly influence their professional practice, our politicians don't face the same sort of guidelines. In this week's edition of FM89's commentary series, The Moral Is, philosophy professor Christopher Myers of CSU Bakersfield says that a recent Supreme Court decision casts the entire issue in a new light.
In a previous contribution to The Moral Is, I discussed how even seemingly trivial gifts can alter physicians' prescribing choices, sometimes to the detriment of their patients. In describing how such a conflict of interest can occur, I noted that humans seem to be hardwired for reciprocity. When someone gives us a gift, even one of low value, we feel obliged to give something in return. This response is so primal, so basic to our nature, that we are frequently unaware of that sense of indebtedness. Instead, we simply act upon it. Since professionals must hold their clients' well-being as primary, such gifts often represent a conflict of interest. as they motivate choices that one might not otherwise make, and because those choices may not be in the client's best interest. All this is why professional organizations like the American Medical Association have taken to strongly discouraging members from accepting any gifts and to requiring full disclosure of any financial relationships. When it comes to political giving, however, the Supreme Court has repeatedly concluded that such standards need not apply. Contributions to, for example, super PACs may be kept anonymous, and donors may give as much as they want, so long as there is no explicitly understood expectation of a direct exchange or quid pro quo. These standards emerge from a series of rulings in which the Supreme Court determined, first, money is a form of free expression protected under the First Amendment. Second, organizations are persons covered by the amendment's protection. And third, donations can be considered corrupting only when they meet the explicit quid pro quo criterion. Each of the associated rulings warrants scrutiny, but I want to focus here on the last. In April's McCutcheon versus FEC, Chief Justice John Roberts, writing for the majority, worded it like this, quote, "Any regulation must target what we have called quid pro quo corruption or its appearance." That Latin phrase captures the notion of a direct exchange of an official act for money, spending large sums of money with the intent of garnering influence over or access to elected officials does not give rise to quid pro quo corruption, end quote. Since I find it implausible that the justices are simply unaware of the scholarly consensus that shows how persons' judgment can be altered by gift-giving, I am left baffled as to how they could reach this conclusion. Is it possible they believe the wealthy few who will be able to garner such influence and access will affect elected officials' judgment only in ways that are to their constituents' benefit? Or that somehow politicians do not have the same basic human instincts of reciprocity and thus are immune to such influence? Whatever their reasoning, one must be deeply disturbed by their conclusions and by the associated impact on our democracy. If you are like me, you want our elected leaders beholden to all of us, not just to the wealthy individuals and organizations who can buy such influence. For The Moral Is, this is Christopher Myers.
Christopher Myers is a professor of philosophy and executive director of the Kegley Institute of Ethics at California State University, Bakersfield. The views expressed are his own and do not necessarily reflect those of the university or the institute or Valley Public Radio. The Moral Is was produced by KVPR and the Bonner Center for Character Education at Fresno State. See more commentaries online at kvpr.org. And now, a moment to reflect on your letters. Last week's story about the planned expansion of the San Joaquin River Parkway through a 1,000-acre parcel known as River West generated a lot of listener comments. The controversy in the story surrounds an attempt by a group of homeowners who live on the San Joaquin River Bluffs to restrict access to the parcel from their neighborhood. The neighbors say increased traffic and parking in their quiet residential area will affect their quality of life, and they're concerned about homeless encampments on the river and even potential fires in the area. We've received a great number of listener comments about this story. One of them came from Karen on Facebook. She writes, "I live on the south side of the river in a neighborhood that is inundated with vehicles in nice weather, so much so that my guests cannot park in front of my home and I can't put my trash cans out until 10 p.m. because the curbs are lined with cars full of people trekking down the street with their rafts and water toys to get in the river. My neighborhood has become a public parking lot. I can see why others might be concerned about that happening in their neighborhood. I don't know that I support blocking public access. I can just say that I relate to the concerns about a private neighborhood street becoming a parking lot where people dump beer bottles, dirty diapers, and other garbage." We also heard from James, another area homeowner. He writes, "I live on the bluff overlooking the potential River West development. Thank you for your story on the obstruction of the park development by a few homeowners. One thing I believe you overlooked is that the obstruction comes from a very small group of homeowners, all of whom live on the 200 block of West Bluff Avenue. Mr. Bowers' claim that he represents anyone is just a bluff. Pardon the pun. Look more carefully, and you will see that this is a small, selfish group of short-sighted people who have benefited from the state's purchase of the River West property and now want no one else to enjoy it. When most of those homes on West Bluff Avenue were built, there was a large golf course community planned for the river bottom. That development would have included homes, swimming pools, and automobiles, and yes, lots of traffic going through that access point. As always, we'd like to hear what you have to say. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, or send us a tweet at KVPR. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. And those are the sounds of jazz saxophone great Bob Mintzer we hear in the background. Mintzer will be performing with his quartet in Fresno tomorrow night in the second of two concerts from Jazz Fresno's Milestones Jazz Program. The first one takes place tonight featuring jazz drum legend Billy Hart. Here to tell us more about this back-to-back night of concerts or nights of concerts, we have Jim Page, who is the director of the Milestones Youth Jazz Program at Jazz Fresno. Jim, welcome.
Thank you, Joe. Good to be here.
I understand your group got started with the annual summer camp on Monday. First, before we talk about the guest artists who are coming in from across the world for this event, tell us about how the kids are responding to jazz camp.
Well, it's really been great so far. We've got almost 75 kids here from 35 different schools, from, you know, Fresno, Clovis, Sanger. We've even got a kid, you know, came up from Southern California, a young lady from Porterville. It's really been great. We just assembled a really outstanding faculty, and these kids are learning how to play jazz.
What is that experience like for them? They're learning from instructors who are veterans, veteran educators. They're also getting a chance to meet some jazz superstars as well.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we have kids of every level here. We've got some kids that, you know, are in their later high school years that have been playing for some time that are, you know, really just young, amazing jazz musicians already. And then we have kids, you know, even as young as fifth, sixth grade, who this is, you know, their absolute first experience with jazz. So we've got all different levels, but, you know, with the faculty that we have assembled, it's really a terrific experience for these kids. And then when you add the fact that we're bringing in some legendary jazz stars from around the country that they can hear and that they can learn from, it's really an amazing experience.
Exactly, and these two concerts that take place starting tonight with the Billy Hart Quartet and then tomorrow night with Bob Mintzer are certainly highlights for any jazz lover's calendar this year in the Central Valley. I want to start out with Billy Hart. This is a drummer who worked with Miles Davis. He was on Miles' legendary album, On the Corner. He worked with Stan Getz. He was part of Herbie Hancock's group. Now he's got his own quartet that's really an all-star band in its own right with a fine saxophone player, Mark Turner, and also Ethan Iverson, who people know from the group The Bad Plus. Tell us about the Billy Hart Quartet.
Well, you know, these guys are, they're just the best the world has to offer. I mean, these are, you know, the top flight, you know, New York jazz guys. And we're just, you know, we were so fortunate to be able to get them to come here to Fresno for this concert.
And let's go ahead and listen to something now from the Billy Hart Quartet again performing tonight at the Bullard High School Theater in Fresno as part of the Jazz Fresno Summer Concert Series with the Milestones Youth Jazz Ensemble, the Billy Hart Quartet on Valley Public Radio. Thank you. music by the Billy Hart Quartet. The jazz drum legend is bringing his band to Fresno tonight to perform for this concert presented by Jazz Fresno and the Milestones Youth Jazz Program. Their summer jazz camp for kids just began on Monday, and they're following the Billy Hart concert tonight with another special concert taking place tomorrow night featuring one of the biggest saxophone stars that's out there in the jazz world today, and that's Bob Mintzer, again performing Wednesday night in Fresno. Tell me about Bob and bringing his quartet to Fresno. That has to be a great thrill.
It really is. I've had a number of people say, man, how did you get Bob Mintzer? And, the answer is pretty simple. I asked him. That was pretty much all there was to it. He's really committed, a committed and profound jazz educator. And, he looks for opportunities to be able to do things like this where he can, both perform in concert and then, share his wealth of knowledge in the clinic setting. But really the even greater surprise was, as we got closer to the date and he called me to tell me who he was bringing with him, I was floored. He's bringing Russell Fronte on piano, and, Russell's, just one of the great jazz pianists in the country, also a member of the Yellow Jackets. And, his bass player, Edwin Livingston, and drummer Steve Schaefer, both just top-flight L.A. jazz musicians. So we're really fortunate to get Bob and these guys in here to Fresno to be doing this concert.
Let's go ahead and listen now to something from Bob Mintzer, the saxophone legend, performing tomorrow night in Fresno. By jazz saxophone icon Bob Mintzer. The Grammy Award winner is performing tomorrow night in a concert with his quartet featuring Russ Ferrante of the Yellow Jackets. I guess you could say there's half of the Yellow Jackets performing in this concert.
Exactly.
Taking place Wednesday night at the Bullard High School Theater, the newly renovated Bullard High School Theater in Fresno. Now, if people want tickets or want more information about going to the concert, what should they do? Where could they go?
Well, the tickets for the Mintzer concert are still available online, at least for a few more hours. They can go to jazzfresno.org to find that list. There are some tickets remaining for Billy Hart Quartet tonight, and they can get those at the door.
Again, Jim Page of Jazz Fresno joining us on Valley Edition today to talk about their upcoming concerts tonight and tomorrow night at the Bullard High School Theater. Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe.
Well, that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, send us your thoughts and comments. The email address is talk@kvpr.org, and on Twitter, we're @KVPR. For Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens here, where we live, learn, work, and play. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.